a camp in Nigeria this year. We did what we've done over the last few years. That we've done a series of Bible studies for the campers. And I generally do about three studies on biblical doctrines. And I'll go through basic subjects in the Bible. In that sense, part of what would be in the index. And they're 12 to 19 or 20 years old there, participating in the camp, plus the staff. And we go through a lot of doctrinal material for them, explaining the Bible in that way. And then at the end of camp, we do Bible Bowl competition, and the questions are taken from the Bible studies that are given. Now, in the process of that, I was discussing angels and how the angels appear, and I began to go into some matters in terms of the creation, and it began to raise questions in their mind, and because it is interactive, and the questions started popping up, and I found that I had to stop and wait, and then the next night go back and expand the study on the creation a little bit more, and then come back and then present that material to the campers as well. So I want to bring part of that to you because it kind of opened my mind conceptually as to what God is doing. And it comes down to this. What is there waiting for us in the kingdom of God? You see, we've had sermons over the years. We've always focused on the lions and the lamb. So we think of the kingdom of God, and here's a child playing by the snake's hole, the adder's hole, and there's the lion laying down, or the, you know, with a lamb. We've got the emblems, and many of us have the insignia from years past. And we tend to think of the kingdom of God in that way. But what is there for us in the kingdom of God that's going to be spiritual? Because the Bible does say that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom. So the kingdom technically is spiritual. Flesh and blood can't inherit it. And so there must be things that are by God's creation and design that have been prepared for us in that way. And then I thought, well, picture God on his throne. What's the image that comes to your mind? God's on his throne. All right, there's what? The sea of glass. And maybe the picture of cherubim around the throne. And there's angels all before the throne that are portrayed in the Bible. And then what do you think of? Well, in my mind, then what I begin to think of is this kind of this empty space all around the back and around everywhere else. And I see kind of a throne, and God on his throne, the angels and the sea of glass, and that's about it. And I thought, I wonder how many of us tend to think of God's creation spiritually in rather limited terms. And so I went through for the campers, and I'd like to, again, I expanded even more for this here today, but I'd like to look at some of what God has prepared for us spiritually. In Psalm 8, verse number 1, we see that God's glory is clearly above all that he has created. Now, we can say, that's fine, we know that, but what he has spiritually is above all that he has created as well on this earth and that we have to see. But Psalm 8, in verse number 1, says, O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth, you who set your glory above the heavens. Out of the mouth of babes and infants you have ordained strength because of your enemies, that you may silence the enemy and the avenger. When I consider the heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you're mindful of him, or the son of man that you visit him? You've made him a little lower than the angels and crowned him with glory and honor. So we see man and all of this creation and the beauty and the trees and the mountains and the lakes and the rivers, the waterfalls, and even what man himself has built, some of the majestic buildings and the beauty and the art that has been produced by man as well. But it just says here, you've made him to have dominion over the work of your hand. You put all things under his feet, sheep and oxen, even beasts of the field, birds of the air, the fish of the sea pass through the paths of the seas. But it says, God says, your name, your glory is above everything there that we see. So if we have dominion over these things, sheep and oxen, beasts of the field, birds of the air, fish of the sea, what does God have? Do we have more than God? does what God created for us go beyond what he has produced for himself? Well, obviously, it could not be so. God's name is exalted above all these things. In Christianity, there are concepts that when we die, if we go to heaven, which is the belief in Christian tradition, largely, that we're going to do what? What are we going to do up there? We're going to play our harp, okay? Maybe blow on a trumpet, and then we'll go back and play the harp. Because those are the only two instruments that I can find that are mentioned in the Bible. God has a harp and a trumpet. And, you know, one night you play the harp, the next night you play the trumpet. Now, we've got all kinds of instruments, hundreds, thousands of instruments, music, and all kinds of combinations of musical instruments, and God has a harp and a trumpet. I don't think so. I don't think it's that way. But I looked up the beatific vision because conceptually in Catholicism, this is from the Catholic Encyclopedia, the idea is you kind of go and stare at God. And you just see him, and that is our potential, to kind of stare at God. And that will be fulfilling. I think it'll be impressive. But, you know, for eternity, you know, we might want to have a few more things. The immediate knowledge of God, from the Catholic Encyclopedia, which the angelic spirits and the souls of the just enjoy in heaven. It's called the beatific vision. It's called a vision to distinguish it from the knowledge of God that human minds attain in this present life. So that's what, that's called immediate knowledge as compared to a vision in heaven. And since in beholding God face to face, the created intelligence finds perfect happiness, the vision is called beatific. So there's the beatific vision. You just go stare at God's face. And you have perfect happiness. And that's all you have to do. So I said, well, there's got to be more than that. So I looked up an article on do pets go to heaven? I thought, you know, I want to expand our exposure a bit. This is from clarifyingchristianity.com. Want to make sure I give credit where credit is due. Now, it's actually reasonably accurate if you still accept the fact that people are going to heaven, which we don't, obviously. But it says, do pets go to heaven? It says, now, before going on, it's most important to state that if pets do go to heaven, their owners will also have to go to heaven to see them. And the Bible makes it clear that the majority of people will not go to heaven. Now, not because we believe, as we do, that they'll be on the earth, but because they're going to that hot spot down there. Okay? Therefore, it is critical that we remind everyone that they need to get right with God themselves, or their chances of seeing a departed pet are zero. That's nice. Won't have to be with Mia for eternity. So where does that leave us? Well, I'm skipping most of the article. Leaves us with the truth. So the truth is, the Bible is silent regarding an afterlife for animals. Now that's nice and honest. An honest assessment. The Bible doesn't really say. However, we do have one hope. The key passage for this question does not deal with animals directly, but rather God's promise to those who inherit God's kingdom, those people who have gotten right with God and will go to heaven themselves, obviously from their perspective. For them, the passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 applies. Eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor has entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for those who love him. Obviously, it says, what God has prepared for us is wonderful beyond comprehension, which means me is not going to be there. Now, I will go back, 1 Corinthians 2, because the passage that is quoted is fundamental to understanding what God has created and prepared for the kingdom, and what it is that we're going to have access to that we maybe don't fully see, obviously, in the same way at this time. 1 Corinthians 2 and verse number 6. It says, we speak wisdom among those who are mature, not the wisdom of this age, nor the rulers of this age who are coming to nothing. But we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery, the hidden wisdom which God ordained before the ages for our glory, which none of the rulers of this age knew. For if they had known, they wouldn't have crucified the Lord of glory, as it is written. Eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor has entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for those who love him. But it goes on. But God has revealed them to us through his Spirit. So isn't available to everyone, and the physical knowledge and experience doesn't reveal it to us, but it says God has revealed these things to us through His Spirit. And the Spirit searches all things, yes, the deep things of God. So I want to just take a peek at some of the deep things of God. We have a tendency to focus on what we can see and feel. Frankly, it's kind of hard to focus on much of anything else, but God does reveal to us other things. Look at Hebrews 5. Hebrews 8, verse number 1. A little further over. Hebrews 8 and 9 reveal to us some things that exist in heaven in very specific ways that I've had to try to kind of mentally incorporate into what I conceive of when I think of heaven now and God on His throne. It says, this is the main point of the things that we're saying. That we have such a high priest who's seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens. A minister of the sanctuary in heaven. So there's a sanctuary there, okay. That makes sense. Where was the ark? In the sanctuary. It was a type of the ark, the throne of God, and the sanctuary in heaven, and of the true tabernacle which the Lord erected and not man. So there's a tabernacle in heaven. The tabernacle on the earth was a type of the tabernacle that was in heaven, as was the sanctuary, as was the ark. So every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices, therefore it's necessary that this one also have something to offer. If he were on earth, he would not be a priest, since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law, who serve the copy and shadow of the heavenly things. So what they're doing is a copy and shadow of what actually exists spiritually in heaven. Okay? As Moses was divinely instructed when he was about to make the tabernacle, he said, see that you make all things according to the pattern shown you on the mountain. So he was given a pattern. He was given blueprints, so to speak. But the pattern and blueprints were of those things that were in heaven that were spiritual. Now he's obtained a more excellent ministry in as much as he is a mediator of a better covenant. Okay, now it goes on, Hebrews 9, over in verse number 11. It's reinforced. Christ came as high priest of the good things to come, with the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation, not of the physical creation. Not with the blood of bulls and goats and calves, but with his own blood, he entered the most holy place once for all. The most holy place ultimately is in heaven, before God's throne, having obtained eternal redemption. But it was not of this creation. So, when you think in terms of what God has created and what the kingdom will contain and what God is doing, it says, well, there's a tabernacle and there's a sanctuary and there's the ark and this is all there where God's throne is. And frankly, it expands a little bit even before that. One of the things I did was I was going through the appearance of the cherubim, which I have addressed before here. But I want to, again, look at it a little more carefully in terms of how the cherubim appear and what the impact of that is on our perspective as well. In the book of Ezekiel, in Ezekiel 1, we have the description of the cherubim before God's throne. Now, what came first, spiritual or physical? The spiritual, okay? Physical came later. So anytime you see something spiritually described, it's saying this existed first. This was in place first, and then the other came along later. So apply that in this context of Ezekiel 1. It says, I looked and behold a whirlwind coming out of the north, a great cloud with raging fire engulfing itself. Brightness was all around it, radiating out of its midst like the color of amber out of the midst of the fire. Again, portraying God's throne. And from within it came the likeness of four living creatures. It turns out they're the cherubim. And this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. The likeness of a man existed before man existed. And it existed in part on a cherubim. Now, we're not made in the image of cherubim, we're made in the image of God, all right? So that's not a confusion that we will make. But notice they had four faces, each one had four wings. Cherubim had wings before birds had wings, and they're not physical, they're spiritual. The legs are straight, and the soles of the feet were like the sole of calves' feet, all right? So where did the hoof come from? Well, from the cherubim first. The cow that came along later with hooves, I mean, even Carl said he had calf muscles. I mean, you know. Says they sparkled like the color of burnished bronze. They had the hands of a man under the wings on their four sides. They had hands before man had hands. Okay? They had four faces and wings. Their wings touched each other. And the creatures did not turn when they went. Each one went straight forward. It says in verse 10, each one had the face of a man. Each one of the four had the face of a lion. Each one had the face of an ox. And each one had the face of an eagle. So when the eagle was created that flies around so majestically, it wasn't the first eagle or the first appearance of an eagle. That image already existed in spirit in heaven. The cherubim had it. And the lion already existed by appearance in heaven, as did the face of a man and the face of an ox. Their wings stretched forward, two wings touched each other, covered their bodies, and it just says they went back and forth and describes them as moving in appearance as a flash of lightning. So when you go and start to realize everything in the tabernacle and the implements and the services they performed were made as copies of the real tabernacle in heaven, and the real eagle's face was in heaven first, the real lion's face was in heaven first, you begin to look around and say, well, you know, we have all these animals, we have all these things and instruments, we have all this beauty, and we have mountains and valleys and rivers. This is a really, really nice place. Well, I think heaven is a really, really nice place. Because God has more than what we have, but he's only revealed to us some of what he has. Enough to let us kind of have a little picture, a window into what he's going to offer, but we know that what he has is certainly better than us. Now, I went through with the campers as well, because Ezekiel 10, let's go to at least Ezekiel 10, verse 14, talks about the cherubim again, had four faces, and the first face was the face of a cherub. The second was the face of a man, the third the face of a lion, the fourth the face of an eagle. So the face of a cherub, the face that represents the cherub primarily, was the face of the ox, which makes perfect sense. What was the image of Baal that was primarily worshipped as an image? It was calf worship. It was the deification of the ox, the cow, because Baal represented Satan, and Satan wanted to be worshipped. Satan had as his primary representation of face the face of an ox, and he had legs with hoofs on them, as was portrayed, and probably some calf muscles as well. Now, what did Aaron offer Israel when they went into the wilderness to worship? A calf. What did Jeroboam offer Israel to worship when they separated in Israel from Judah? Well, two calves. What was it that actually was used in Assyria that is sitting in the British Museum right now today? I've seen them. Dari was there for the tour when the ministry went. He described it as well, that they're the winged bulls of Assyria that sat before, it was the entrance to the throne room where you could, they were the protectors of the throne. Now that's interesting. They're bulls with wings on them and the face of a man. And those were the images. They're right there. You can look them up and get a picture of them on the internet. And so, you know, Satan has inserted himself repeatedly. But the important issue that I'm trying to represent is that all of these things existed in the spirit creation before they existed in the physical creation. And it's not like we have everything and God has only a little and then someday we get to go be with him and don't have much either. That's not the way it's going to be. All we have is just a scratch, I'm sure, of what God has already created and produced and what he rejoices in and wants to share with us one day. As I said, the Bible said that there's musical instruments in there. And the book of Revelation shows the harp, and they play the harp, and shows that. It shows the trumpets being blown by the angels. Again, do you think God has two instruments? Just because it doesn't describe all the different varieties of instrumentation and music and the choral orchestras and the songs they sing doesn't mean they don't exist. God certainly has more than what we have. He has eternity to use and to develop and to create and to enjoy and to modify as he chooses and sees fit, those things that we will get to rejoice in as well. I made a comment during the Bible study. As Dari had been busy on something, he walked in the middle of the study, And I was just telling them, you know, I actually believe as well that there are horses in heaven. And I looked over at Dar, and you could tell he goes, oh, yeah, there's horses in heaven, you know. So I smiled, and I went up to Dar after the Bible study. I says, Dar, you don't believe there's horses in heaven? He says, I don't think so. I said, okay. Tomorrow night, I'll come back. I'll build my case a little more firmly. And I'll just tell you, I believe that there are horses in heaven. And I'll show you how that plays out scripturally. 2 Kings chapter 6. I'm not saying that every portrayal of a horse in the Bible is a real literal horse. There are various visions that are portrayed in different ways. But I do believe that some of the portrayals in the Bible portray something that God has literally created in a spiritual sense. It is part of his mighty host. And we don't know what all that host includes. But again, bear with me at least long enough to get to the scripture before you start daydreaming and wonder where I have gone. 2 Kings 6 and verse 15, this is the account where Syria has surrounded Jerusalem, and God is going to intervene on behalf of his people. Verse 15 says, when the servant of the man of God arose early and went out, there was an army surrounding the city with horses and chariots. And his servant said to him, alas, my master, what shall we do? He answered, don't fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them. Don't worry, it's going to be fine. Elisha prayed and said, Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see. And the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire. All right? These are spirit horses, and they have chariots that they actually are portrayed with all around Elisha. Now, I don't have a problem if you look at that and you say, well, that's just an analogy or portrayal. That's not really a description of something that God actually has created. And I can only say, let's go back then to 2 Kings chapter 2 and verse number 8. When Elijah was going to be replaced by Elisha, there's an event here that's worded in such a way that tilts to me the fact that, you know, we don't have all these things down here and God has nothing. Well, God has more than what we even imagine. He has things we've never even known about or seen. But it says in verse number 8 of 2 Kings 2, Elijah took his mantle, rolled it up, struck the water, and it was divided this way and that so that the two of them crossed over on dry ground. And so it was when they crossed over that Elijah said to Elisha, ask what I may do for you before I am taken away from you. And Elisha said, please let a double portion of your spirit be upon me. He said, you have asked a hard thing. Nevertheless, if you see me when I am taken from you, it shall be so to you, but if not, it shall not be so. Then it happened, and they continued on and talked, and suddenly a chariot of fire appeared with horses of fire and separated the two of them, and Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. Now Elisha saw it and cried out, my father, my father. Now let me think, how would he have said that? What in the world is this? Are you kidding me? Horses and chariots of fire? Who do you think I am? No, he said, my father, my father, the chariot of Israel and its horsemen. He recognized it. This is not an exclamation of something he'd never imagined or seen before. Now, when God appears to his prophets, and he showed things to Moses, and when he taught things even to Adam and Eve, we don't know exactly what all he taught them and showed them. But in the Bible, constantly there are things revealed. All of a sudden, you know, you're not supposed to do this, or you're not supposed to do that. And it just comes in there that it was something that had been known all along. But he said, why, that's the chariot of Israel and its horsemen. And he saw him no more, and he took hold of his own clothes and tore them in two pieces. So I look at that, and I said, wow, that just looks too familiar to me. He said, oh, I know what that is. And it's Israel's horse and chariot. And so I think, well, okay. But let me take that just a little further. Genesis 1, verse 24. Again, why... when I look at the Bible, I'm looking now and I'm trying to see God a little more fully and at least what our potential is. The kingdom of God is ultimately spiritual. But in Genesis 1:24, notice the way this is worded. It says, God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind, cattle and creeping thing, and beast of the earth, according each according to its kind, and it was so. So a cow has a cow, and a cat has a cat, and a dog has a dog, and it's according to its kind. Well, where did the kind come from? Where was the kind? Where was the original in place? Notice verse 25. God made the beast of the field according to its kind. Now, he's saying in verse 24 that it's going to reproduce after its kind. It'll keep reproducing the same thing. But in verse 25, he doesn't say it quite the same way. He said he made the beast of the earth according to its kind, which means there was a cow kind. There was a lion kind. There was a ox kind. There was an eagle kind. That's the way I read that. Cattle according to its kind, everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind, and God saw that it was good. So he took the animals and he made them according to the kind, according to the model, according to the template. And then he put them here on the earth. I think that's pretty amazing. And again, that's why it tends to wait for me a little bit when I look at some of the more specific references in other places. I go, you know, I really think there is a horse kind spiritually out there as well. If we go to Hebrews 7, we see another account, a little different way, it goes in a little different direction, but it says Melchizedek in Hebrews 7, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. Now we looked at Melchizedek and we've seen the description. It says here, to whom Abraham gave a tenth part of all, first being translated king of righteousness, but then also king of Salem, meaning king of peace. Without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, remains a priest continually. So we look back and recognize Jesus Christ in a descriptive way being portrayed as Melchizedek, the priest of the Most High God, and also the king of Salem. Now consider how great this man was, to whom even the patriarch Abraham paid a tenth of his spoils. Indeed, those who are the sons of Levi, who receive priesthood, have a commandment to receive tithes from the people according to the law, that is, from their brethren, though they have come from the loins of Abraham. But he whose genealogy is not derived from them received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. Now beyond all contradiction, the lesser is blessed by the better. Here mortal men receive tithes, but there he receives them, in contrast to mortal, immortal, eternal Jesus Christ, of whom it is written that he lives. And it goes on and finishes. Now, the word Salem means peace. And if you look up the word, it's actually even broader than simply peace. It's a very broad term of usage. It's related to shalom, which relatively means peace, but again, has a broader context. And it's also a reference, ultimately, to Jerusalem. Salem and Jerusalem are sometimes interchanged in that way. So we have here, it says that he is a king of Salem. Now, where would he be king of? A king is a king over a kingdom, over a place, over a thing or something in that respect. So he was a king. Jesus Christ is referred to as a king. If you go back to Genesis 14 and look at the actual account, it's possible that the city of Salem existed, but there's no record of it. The only record is that he's king of Salem. But notice the book of Joshua chapter 15. Joshua 15 traces the beginning of Jerusalem and where Jerusalem came from. This is considerably further down the line from Abraham. And what we see here, Joshua 15 and verse number 63, we see that the Jebusites, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, so Jerusalem is now first mentioned in the Bible, okay? And it's populated by Jebusites. And it says the children of Judah couldn't drive them out. But the Jebusites dwell with the children of Judah at Jerusalem to this day. So before they were driven out and before the Jews occupied Jerusalem, the Jebusites lived in Jerusalem. And do you know what the name of it was? Well, it was named after the occupants. Go over just a little bit to Joshua 18 and verse number 28, and you have the answer, when it's again now talking about the land that is going to be inheritance of the children of Benjamin. It says, Zelah, Aleph, Jabus, which is Jerusalem. So the Jebusites lived in Jabus. And the name Jabus eventually became Jerusalem. Now that's way, way, way down the line from Melchizedek in the king of Salem back in the account of Genesis. So I would say, okay, was Melchizedek a spirit being, king of a physical city? Or would he not possibly have been king of a spiritual city? Would that not make a little better sense if we were to process it in that way? Is there another Salem or another Jerusalem mentioned in the Bible? Well, there certainly is. Psalm 76. Again, if we just look, and God says he reveals it by his Spirit, and he's put little guides through the Bible and said, well, look at this. Well, think about this. And when you begin to put it together, I think it does expand. Psalm 76, verse 1, says, in Judah God is known. His name is great in Israel. In Salem also is his tabernacle. Now, at the time of the Psalms, there was a tabernacle in Jerusalem. So you could say, well, that's just a reference to Jerusalem, his dwelling place in Zion. So Jerusalem is called Salem and also Jerusalem, and it's also called Zion. And it says, there he broke the arrows of the bow, the shield, and the sword of battle. All right, so far we could argue that that is a physical description. Now, let's just go a little further over to Galatians 4 and verse 21. We're going to see that there is a spiritual Jerusalem as well. Galatians 4 and verse number 21. Paul here making a contrast between Mount Sinai and another mountain, between what is physically created and what is spiritual. Tell me, you who desire to be under the law, do you not hear the law? For it is written that Abraham had two sons, one by a bondwoman, the other one by a free woman. But he who was of the bondwoman was born according to the flesh. He is a free woman through promise, miraculously, spiritual miracle. Which things are symbolic? For these are the two covenants. The one from Mount Sinai gives birth to a bondage, which is Hagar, physical Mount Sinai. For this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia and corresponds to Jerusalem, which now is physical Jerusalem and is in bondage with her children. Verse 26, but the Jerusalem above is free, which is the mother of us all. There's a Jerusalem above. Because it's contrasting Mount Sinai with what other mount would Jerusalem be called? Mount Zion. And there is a physical Mount Zion, Jerusalem, where the temple was built, but there's also a spiritual Mount Zion. Notice Revelation 21. We can take these things and we can say, well, that's not real, that's just a story, or that's just a portrayal, or that's just a vision, and that's, and you can go on and on and on, but it very clearly says there was a Jerusalem above, there's a tabernacle above, there's a sanctuary above, there's a temple and an ark, a throne above, there's a whole Jerusalem. Revelation 21, verse 9, one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls filled with the seven last plagues came to me, and he talked with me, saying, come, I'll show you the bride, the Lamb's wife. He carried me away in the Spirit to a great and high mountain, and he showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God. Now it says, Jerusalem descends out of heaven from God, having the glory of God, and it describes then how the city or parts of the city appear. Now again, what's another name for Jerusalem? Okay, Zion or Mount Zion, and I would say then it's very heavenly Mount Zion as well. Psalm chapter 9. And verse number 9. It says, the Lord will be a refuge for the oppressed, a refuge in times of trouble. and those who know your name will put their trust in you. For you, Lord, have not forsaken those who seek you. Sing praises to the Lord who dwells in Zion. It says God dwells in Zion. Now, okay, you say, well, okay, now, but that's the Zion down there in Jerusalem. That's where God lives. Well, you can't contain God in a temple, but regardless, let's go forward. Declare his deeds among the people. When he avenges blood, he remembers them. He does not forget the cry of the humble. Have mercy on me, O Lord. Consider my trouble from those who hate me. You who lift me up from the gates of death, that I may tell of all your praise in the gates of the daughter of Zion. I'll rejoice in your salvation. So now in one passage, we have a contrast between God dwelling in Zion, and we have here David crying out that he will cry out from the daughter of Zion. So the Zion and the daughter of Zion are mentioned in the same place, and they're not the same. Psalm 50, just go over a little further here, and notice the way this is described, Psalm 50 and verse 1. The mighty one, God the Lord, has spoken and called the earth from the rising of the sun to its going down. Out of Zion, God's calling, out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, God will shine forth. It's not talking about a physical place or a physical circumstance. It's talking about God shining forth. Our God shall come and shall not keep silent. A fire shall devour before him, and it shall be very tempestuous all around him. He shall call to the heavens from above. Okay, so he's above when he calls. And to the earth that he may judge his people. So it portrays God in Zion, calling out, shining forth to the heavens, to the earth. He's not on the earth. He's not in Jerusalem. Gather my saints together to me, those who have made a covenant with me by sacrifice. That the heavens declare his righteousness, for God himself is judge. So there's Jerusalem and there's Mount Zion in heaven as well. God hasn't chintzed himself out of anything. God has everything. We think we have everything and we have very little. Imagine what it is possible that God is going to reveal to us when he allows us to see all of his creation as he sees it as well, as he cried out, and God, let them see it. Let them have eyes to see. We hardly even know much of what is on the earth, frankly, in many places, let alone what is in the universe. There's things we read about, but most of us will never, ever get to see them. And I do believe part of that is what eternity is for, or at least what will be available to us in the course of eternity. Look at Deuteronomy 4. God has prepared for us so many things, and they're going to last, and they're going to have variety and beauty and opportunity and excitement and adventure. I look for that. I desire that. Deuteronomy 4, verse number 15. It says, take careful heed to yourselves, for you saw no form when the Lord spoke to you at Horeb out of the midst of the fire, lest you act corruptly and make for yourself a carved image, and in the form of any figure, the likeness of male or female, the likeness of any beast that's on the earth, or the likeness of any winged bird that flies in the air, the likeness of anything that creeps on the ground, or the likeness of any fish that's in the water beneath the earth. Take heed lest you lift up your eyes to heaven, and when you see the sun, the moon, the stars, and all the host of heaven, and you feel driven to worship and serve them, which the Lord your God has given to all the people under the whole heaven as a heritage. He says it is our heritage to be able to go out there and see the universe. It's going to be there in some form that we can go out there, and it is being held for us. It has been prepared. Ultimately, it will be cleansed and purified. It will be changed in ways, but it will be there for us to see. Ecclesiastes 3. God didn't reveal all of these things to us beyond what we see. But he did reveal to us some. And he gave us the ability to ponder and wonder and to discern and to seek his spirit to open our eyes to see what he has shown us. Ecclesiastes 3 and verse number 9. Excuse me, I'm actually in the wrong book. Thought I was there. What profit has the worker from that which he labors? I mean, just his paycheck? Is that what you have? I see even the God-given task with which the Son of Man are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in his time, but he has also put eternity in their hearts. This desire to see, this perception of understanding what God has created and built and prepared for us, and our desire for it. He has put eternity in our hearts. Except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. God hasn't revealed it all to us. He's revealed to us in some ways very little. I know that there's nothing better for them to rejoice, to do good in their lives, and also that man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor that is the gift of God. I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing shall be added or can be added to it, nothing taken from it. God does it that men should fear before him. That which is has already been. Well, isn't that amazing? We can expand that. We can say, well, this happened yesterday, deja vu. But it says that which is has already been. There's more like that where it came from. Maybe that's part of it. And what is to be has already been. God requires an account of what is past. We become accountable for how we use what God has given us to do. There's another passage in Isaiah 9, that has always had kind of an interest to me because I can only understand it to a degree, but it's encouraging just the same. Isaiah 9, verse 6. It's a prophecy. It's a prophecy of God and his governance and his creation and how it's going to play out. Unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. The government will be upon his shoulder. His name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. It says of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. There will always be more. Now, I don't know exactly how that can be. But he says there will always be increase of government and peace. On the throne of David and over his kingdom to order and establish it with justice and judgment from that time forward, even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform it. I think it's incredible that I'm never going to run out of things that are of interest to me. I'm never going to run out of places and things to see and experience and explore. It will be fresh or new or exciting. And for eternity, there's going to be creation and production and governance and peace. The way God has laid that out. See, I get bored kind of easy. I almost need stress just to keep me awake. I'm always, God knows, always being gone is not for everybody. But it kind of suits me in part because I almost need to have a deadline. I almost need to have something changed to keep my focus. Encouraging to me when God says, well, don't worry, it's never going to end. There'll always be more. There'll be something different. You know, we've run camp now in Nigeria for a number of years in this one place. We've got it down, you know, absolutely down to a system. We've got all the studies organized, and I've got all my notes for the doctrinal studies, and I can go through and bring them along, and then we do the Bible Bowl, and we've got the rope bridge that we run, and we've got rock climbing, and we've now brought Cody and Bobby Kipps brought softball this year, first time we've had softball, and they brought bats and gloves and bases. It was so amazing to be out there, and you tell everybody what they must do, and they hit that ball, and then they run right past the base and step right over the base and keep right on running, and you call them back, and they cannot believe it. No, they touched that base. I said, no, you didn't. I was watching that base. You didn't. You have to touch it with your foot, you know. All the little tiny rules. We had so much fun, and it's a brand new sport. And, you know, we've run that camp every year now, and we've got it right down to where everything works, so you know what we need to do? We need to go somewhere else, start over. I mean, why would you want to have something that works? I mean, wouldn't you want to have to rebuild it every so often just for fun? So we went to the beach this year and took a little motorboard out through the mangroves and stuff and got out on the beach in his palms and coconut palms, and they're walking up and handing us, you know, I've mentioned this, but hand the dried fish and the coconut and going,
you know, darn, this would be a great place for camp, wouldn't it? She says, yeah, I'd really like this. And so we're already thinking about all the things we can do on the beach at camp and stay in tents, you know, and have a good time. And I just figured, you know, why not? Why not do something different? Mr. Keller says, boy, it should be a shame if they can't go rock climbing. You built that program and it's very special. And he said, maybe every other year you could go back and do the rock climbing activity as well. I said, well, we'll see. But right now I just imagine sand between my toes, you know, and the waves coming in and how much fun we would have doing something different. Well, we're going to get to do things different for eternity. That's my concept. That's what I look to. Deuteronomy 29:29. Deuteronomy 29:29 says, the secret things belong to the Lord our God. Okay? So there's some things he's just not going to tell us. We don't need to know. But the things he does tell us have a purpose, and it ought to give us a particular focus. He says, but those things that are revealed belong to us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law. So the whole point of what God reveals to us is to bring us into relationship to him so that we can obey him, so that he can work with us, so that we can have what he has one day. But that's the point of what is revealed. So he doesn't tell us every kind of animal that exists in the spirit realm or every kind of form or shape or how many instruments he has and what utility they have to him in various ways. He doesn't express all of that to us because we don't need to know. But he does tell us many things. He says, the whole purpose of what I reveal is so that you will obey me, do my words, look to me, and recognize I am God, and I have called you into my service. Psalm 16 to me is also important in this regard, because it goes back to the fact that, you know, we're not going to just go up there, sit on a cloud in heaven, play with a harp, blow a little trumpet, stare at God in his face, and have this beatific vision. That's just not how this is played out or portrayed. But Psalm 16 and verse number 9 says, therefore my heart is glad and my glory rejoices. My flesh also will rest in hope, for you will not leave my soul in Sheol or the grave, nor will you allow your Holy One to see corruption. So it's a prophecy of Jesus Christ. But notice the finish. You will show me the path of life. In your presence is fullness of joy, and at your right hand are pleasures forevermore. You know, spirit has got to be different than being physical, but let's just say being physical. If you do something and you do it again and again and again and again, at some point in time, it's just not quite as much fun or excitement as it was the first time. And so then we get a chance to go maybe and do something else. But it says here, in his right hand are pleasures forevermore. And what that tells me is there's a lot there. There's way more there than we can even imagine. If there's a lot here, God has more. This is just a little tiny subset of what he has for himself. But he says he wants to give us what he has one day. What an incredible blessing. What a great way that God has begun to reveal himself so that we might come into his service, serve him, and obey him faithfully, and teach our children to do so as well.